From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR correspondents from around the globe. I'm Dee Dee Skanky. This week, we review a contentious issue for some at the State Department, and in Israel, a wall of contention is removed. We also go to Peru for a not-so-high high. But we start this week's podcast with a historic withdrawal in Iraq and a deadly inundation in Pakistan. A year ago, there were some 160,000 U.S. troops in Iraq. With this week's withdrawal of the last combat brigade, U.S. forces there are down to 50,000. The 4th Stryker Brigade, 2nd Infantry Division, drove from north of Baghdad to the crossing in Kuwait, tracing in reverse the route the U.S. Army took when it invaded Iraq more than 7 years ago. NPR's Mike Schuster caught up with some of the withdrawing troops at Camp Adder, near the southern city of Nasiriyah.
Eighty Stryker armored vehicles reached the main gate of Camp Adder in late morning when the sun was already high and the desert was baking at a brutal 130 degrees. Each vehicle, bristling with firepower, carries about 10 soldiers. They had been rolling slowly down Iraq's main north-south highway for about 12 hours, a very visible display of the U.S. intention to bring its war in Iraq to a close, or nearly that. The Strykers came to Camp Adder to refuel, to give the soldiers a few hours of sleep, and to prepare for the last leg of the journey to Kuwait and then to home. And that's exactly what soldiers had on their mind as they moved their vehicles through the clouds of desert dust to their first stop here, the refueling spot.
I think it's a pretty good idea. I think we got what we needed to get done here. You know, they're a lot more independent and stuff here, so pretty good.
I think it's good. I think our job is done here. I just can't wait to get home to my wife and little boy.
I think we have started really well. I don't know if there's more that we can do, but I know we've done good so far.
I think we came here to liberate freedom for a country. Things are going to happen, but our main objective we came here to do has been accomplished, in my opinion.
Each of these men, Sergeant Alexander LaRoche, Specialists Sean Warner and Matthew Cullum, and Private First Class Kevin Sanders, has been in Iraq for the last year. Their brigade has seen combat, but it's been a period of lessening conflict in contrast to the intense sectarian war in late 2006, early 2007. Still, there are threats along the main road south to Kuwait. Later that night, Chief Warrant Officer Gus McKinney briefed the convoy's commanders about what to expect. Recently, he said there have been 10 roadside bomb attacks along the last 100 miles inside Iraq.
Most of those IEDs have been surface laid, not big ones, okay? There have been two EFPs, right here and right here, but not catastrophic, okay? We have not had attack on the route since 3 August.
IEDs, of course, are improvised explosive devices. EFPs are explosively formed projectiles, a much more powerful bomb. McKinney displayed maps and surveillance photos to brief his soldiers. But some were already thinking about history and how the U.S. war in Iraq will be seen. That was on Captain Dennis Grindy's mind as he addressed his company.
This is our nation's life's work, right here. There are guys that have joined the Army and have honorably retired from the Army and have not seen this thing resolved. Well, you'll see it resolved. You're going to see it tonight. We're about to put the end on a big chapter in a book of military history. You should be proud of yourselves.
That may be true for most of the American troops who have served in Iraq, but not for the 50,000 who will remain for another 15 months, nor for the Iraqis themselves. If anyone needed a reminder that Iraq is still plagued by violence, it came Tuesday in central Baghdad, just as the last Strykers were rolling toward the Kuwait border. A suicide bomber blew himself up in the midst of a crowd of Iraqi police recruits, killing 61. The scene was reminiscent of the mayhem of 3 years ago when the insurgency, spearheaded by al-Qaeda in Iraq, seemed to command a never-ending supply of militants willing to commit suicide in their war with the U.S. and its Baghdad allies. Back at Camp Adder, Lieutenant Colonel Mike Lawrence, the battalion commander, said the U.S. has done everything possible to stabilize Iraq.
We've given them enough time to get it right themselves, you know, secure the election, secure the population, defeat any government forces. It's time to go home. And, you know, wish them the best of luck with the future. But at the same time, it demonstrates our commitment to the people of this country that we'll be strategic allies. Our friendships are eternal, last, not just this movement, not just this next year, but for the years to come.
Soon after that, some of the last of the 4th Stryker Brigade, 2nd Infantry Division, left Camp Adder, and a short 4 hours later, as the sun was just rising, crossed into Kuwait. Mike Schuster, NPR News, Baghdad.
Now to Pakistan, where floodwaters have devastated an enormous swath of the country. It's hard to grasp what it means to have 20 million people displaced by floods, but you get a sense when you listen to people trying to help a single Pakistani village. NPR's Julie McCarthy has the story.
The rains are unrelenting, and flooding that began more than 2 weeks ago in the mountainous northwest of Pakistan has now swept over about one quarter of the country. As it spread, it has engulfed the southern Punjab, the country's farm belt. In the district of Muzaffargarh, parts of the landscape have turned into a series of islands as floodwaters surround mounds of what is left of dry land. A truck loaded with supplies, the engine occasionally stalling, navigates the waters in a bid to reach those stranded in the village of Shugar. Pakistan's Indus River, the cradle of civilization in this part of the world, has swelled to 15 miles at points. Millions fled for their lives, one step ahead of the rising waters. Thousands remain cut off. The stranded say the rescue services are inadequate for large numbers of families seeking safer ground. Residents are relying on the kindness of people like Ghulam Mustafa and his band of mechanics turned relief workers.
You've raised money back home in another district to come here 4 days in a row to deliver food. Is that right? 4 days in a row?
5 days, they shout. Residents of Shugar, a rise of land now separated by water, say the government has left them to their own devices. 26-year-old Mohammed Nadim runs relief to this water-soaked area.
Has there been any government relief that's come
here? Government.
No government.
No government. No government.
Tell me, how many people are stranded here?
2,000,
he says, and there could be more. The government is fragile and unpopular, but also without many resources to marshal. The only institution with any real heft is the Pakistan Army. It is sheltering 60,000 residents in the southern Punjab. But the misery even in those camps is audible. Hundreds queue at night for meager rations in the mud as children gather water from a rudimentary pump. But one mother of six tells me the supplies are beyond her wildest imagination. Mushahid Khurshid's family of eight, on the other hand, has taken refuge in a plastic tent, strung with a few pieces of clothing they have left. He says his children are getting sick, but he dares not complain to the army. One case of cholera has been reported in the floods. Aid agencies express fears that disease in overcrowded and unsanitary camps may lead to epidemics. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, in the southern Punjab.
This week, the Israeli military began removing a wall, but not just any wall. Israel says it's the first time it's removing a protective structure from a neighborhood that was directly targeted by Palestinian militants. The wall protected the Jewish settlement of Gilo on the southeast edge of Jerusalem against attacks from the nearby Palestinian village of Beit Jalal. And the reason for its removal, according to Israel, is a much improved security situation. But Palestinians say the move is self-serving and superficial. Shira Frankel reports from Jerusalem.
The clanging of metal chains lifting concrete slabs into the air and onto military trucks doesn't seem to bother too many of the residents at Ha'anafa Street. For nearly a decade, this 10-foot-high, 1.2-mile-long wall was a stark reminder that this neighborhood was the target of some of the earliest attacks of the Second Intifada. But Israeli security officials say that tensions have now subsided between the Palestinian village of Beit Jalal and Gilo. The Israeli settlement was built on land seized by Israel in the 1967 war. Israel now considers it a suburb of Jerusalem. During the second Palestinian uprising in the year 2000, Gilo was the target of regular sniper fire and occasional mortar attacks from Palestinian militants across a ravine in nearby Beit Jalal. But the Palestinian security forces that now operate in Beit Jalal have received high praise from Israel and from American officials for restoring order there. The IDF largely credits their work for the decision to remove the Gilo wall. Rami Cohen, a 53-year-old resident of Gilo, says his car was hit by bullets during one of the shooting attacks. Still, he thinks the wall should have come down years ago.
I don't think this is something that really helped. It always just separated us from our problems. Not just this wall, but the whole other wall is really a bad move by Israel.
He's referring to the much larger separation barrier that winds in and around the occupied West Bank. Some Israelis who protested the original Gilo wall are now discussing ways in which they can use its removal to strengthen their campaign against the separation barrier. But most Palestinians are not as hopeful. Ghassem Khatib is a spokesman for the Palestinian Authority. Speaking by phone from his home in Ramallah, he shrugs off any claim that dismantling the Gilo wall could herald bigger things.
I don't think that there is any significance in this step. Now, they say that they removed it because they feel that things are more secure. If this is correct, then they should have better removed some of the barriers that are making our life terrible, like some of the checkpoints or some of the wall.
Some residents of Gilo seem apprehensive about the decision to remove the wall, which has long been the focus of their community. Tourists came to photograph it, and artists held contests to determine who would decorate the concrete slabs. Mordechai Sachavia is one of the original founders of Gilo 35 years ago. He gestures across the ravine towards Beit Jala, pointing out places where Palestinian gunmen took up positions years ago. He argues that the wall should not be removed.
It could be that the violence will just come back again. There's no way of knowing. They could take it down and tomorrow the shooting will start again.
The IDF soldiers removing the wall are working quickly. They expect to have it completely dismantled within 2 weeks. Still, they aren't taking any chances. As they hoist the concrete slabs onto the back of a flatbed truck, they number the pieces. That way, they say, it'll be easy to put back together again. For NPR News, I'm Shira Frankel in Jerusalem.
Coming up, not-so-retiring State Department retirees and a trippy trip to Peru.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Dee Dee Skanky. When are you too old to represent the United States abroad? That question is on the minds of some Foreign Service officers bumping up against the mandatory retirement age. The rule doesn't apply to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton or to ambassadors, but it does to mid-level diplomats who are in short supply these days. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
From her post in Karachi, Pakistan, Elizabeth Colton has had a busy summer trying to improve America's image and deal with devastating floods. She also has a more personal problem on her hands. Yesterday was her 65th birthday, something she would have liked to celebrate, but in her case, it means the end of a career path she loves.
You know, it's not like the age of one becomes decrepit. In fact, maybe you have more energy, more focused energy.
Colton seems to thrive on her seven-day-a-week job, spending her birthday visiting flood victims in camps in Karachi. She's not retiring without a fight. Last year, she filed a lawsuit calling the mandatory retirement age unconstitutional. And she's been pushing from within, finally getting a one-year extension to work in Cairo. Like many of the Foreign Service officers running up against this mandatory retirement age, Colton came to the job late in life after other careers, including a job as NPR's diplomatic correspondent.
Yeah, I was a journalist. I was an anthropologist. I was press secretary. I was a professor. It was a childhood dream that I wanted to be a diplomat as well as a journalist and an adventurer.
Another former journalist, Diana Page, is currently working at the State Department assisting foreign reporters in Washington. Fluent in Spanish and Portuguese, she's served in, among other places, Guyana, Chile, Bosnia, and northeastern Brazil. She's ready to put in a few more years, but she's 64.
So I have one more year left. If I could bid on overseas jobs, possibly, then I would be able to extend for, you know, a two-year or a three-year assignment, and I would then reach my full Social Security age. I would make another contribution, perhaps, in a country, and I would do what I love doing.
Page is not suing, but has been trying to get the attention of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton at town hall meetings. She's been rehearsing her question.
And my question is, Madam Secretary, as you have said, this is a great job. You're clearly enjoying being Secretary of State. Do you think it's fair that I have to retire being your age and you don't? You know, no, but I haven't had a chance to raise it.
State Department spokesman P.J. Crowley says the department is guided by the Foreign Service Act of 1980, which sets the retirement age but also allows the secretary to give limited extensions. He says the idea is to make sure younger Foreign Service officers have a chance to move up. Crowley adds retirees can come back on temporary assignments.
We look at creative ways of continuing to use these talented people. We have lots of different programs to do that.
AFSA, which represents the interests of Foreign Service employees, is calling on the department to be more transparent about all of that. Members are still split on the broader issue of retirement, according to the president of the American Foreign Service Association, Susan Johnson.
We've heard from quite a number of members who want to see the retirement age raised to 67 to put it in sync with Social Security. AFSA's annual survey, which went out last fall, showed that member opinion was roughly equally divided for or against raising the retirement age.
While the professional association looks into the issue, Foreign Service Officer Colton argues in her lawsuit that age discrimination shouldn't be tolerated at all, that there should be no age limit. She calls it a matter of civil rights. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
And now for a not-so-comfy walk on the wild side. The Peruvian Amazon attracts thousands of foreign tourists each year with its jungle tours, but increasingly, visitors go for something else, to sample ayahuasca. That's a potion made from jungle vines and considered sacred by Indians. Lodges catering to ayahuasca tourism are sprouting up all over, and tourists arrive for days of rituals they say provide them with a window into the soul. NPR's Juan Ferrero reports from Iquitos, Peru.
The rain falls hard outside the Yacupuma Healing Center. This wooden lodge, surrounded by lush greenery, sits on the town's outskirts here in northeastern Peru. And the shaman, a medicine man named Juan Tangoa, sits before a bottle filled with what looks like sludge.
Cuando ya bebo esta cosa, voy a hacer, digamos, un contacto al mundo espiritual, ¿no? Que esos ícaros que cantamos.
He tells a small group of Americans and Europeans that drinking the concoction will lead to contact with a spiritual world. He says that his ícaros, or chants, will invoke the spirits. Each visitor is given a shot, and it's not long before Tangoa's charges are sick. Ayahuasca, you see, is not simply for those looking for an easy walk on the wild side. The potion does contain a chemical with hallucinogenic properties, but you won't find hippies here looking for a trip. That's because the shamans consider ayahuasca a medicine. And the people who come, businessmen, computer programmers, salesmen, musicians, are looking to deal with everything from childhood traumas to depression. Like Brendan Everett, a 31-year-old camera salesman from Los Angeles.
I thought something was missing from my life. You know, and walking through the world just being like, okay, I have this job I hate. I feel miserable most of the time. Like, everything's small. And just how I related to people wasn't, it was very superficial and it wasn't a very deep connection.
For some, ayahuasca induces purges from both ends of the body. There are ghoulish dreams, fear, paranoia, screams, as shown in Keith Aronowitz's documentary about ayahuasca, Metamorphosis.
Ah! Oh, I'm not scared of you anymore. Go away.
Sometimes it takes days and several sessions for a person consuming ayahuasca to get something out of it. That's how it was for Everett.
So my first ceremony, there was no visions, there was no purging. It was just kind of me sitting there and laying there being like, I don't know what's going on, I don't know what's going on. And over the course of the five ceremonies, I realized that at that time, I had to just get really dark and really let go of any preconceived expectation that I had.
What Everett let go of were his demons. His shaman is an American, Hamilton Souther, a 32-year-old Californian who studied anthropology at the University of Colorado.
There are huge swings in mood, huge swings in psychic states, huge swings in physical states, and the shaman has to be able to literally hold that space so that a person is safe as they go through those different movements.
Souther came here nearly a decade ago and trained for 2 years to become a master shaman. Now he runs the Blue Morpho Ayahuasca Center, an hour outside of Iquitos. Ayahuasca use is legal in Peru, and tourism operators say 20% of visitors who come here come for ayahuasca. They are enticed by the curative properties, though Souther says not everyone leaves satisfied.
The problem is that there will be a whole nother group of people that will receive absolutely no benefit from drinking ayahuasca.
On a recent day, though, several repeat visitors mill around at Blue Morpho's headquarters. They include two New Zealanders who work for an armored car company, a computer programmer from Salt Lake City, a young environmentalist who says ayahuasca made him feel like trying again. And then there's Brendan Everett, the camera salesman, back to Peru for a fourth time.
There's not this gigantic weight on my shoulders anymore, and I can sit up straight and I can breathe normally and just be like, the world's just a significantly brighter, more beautiful place now.
Juan Ferrero, NPR News.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Dee Dee Skanky.